91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. The richest Silicon Valley startup by far is the online taxi-like service Uber. It's also a company generating negative coverage, including this week's executive resignation after a medical records impropriety. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Uber has gained such recognition that it joins the few companies that are verbs. Let's Uber to the airport tomorrow. Uber is worth some $70 billion, though it's only 7 years old. Top execs have resigned, and it's alleged to operate in a climate of sexism perpetrated by male brogrammers. Uber's CEO, Travis Kalanick, seems the epitome of a ruthless CEO in pursuit of success. Next, we'll learn more about the Uber book written by Fortune magazine executive director Adam Leshinsky. First, it's news. And Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and today's topical currents. If Fortune magazine executive editor Adam Leshinsky wanted a perfect storm for the release of his book about Uber, his wish has come true. Revelations of alleged transgression by Uber are relentless.
Today it's reported that the Uber Technologies, Inc. Board of Directors voted to adopt all recommendations from a report about sexual harassment and other violations at the company issued by former Attorney General Eric Holder.
Last week it was a rape victim's medical records carried around by an Uber executive who then resigned. So we turn to Adam Leshinsky for analysis of the world's richest Silicon Valley startup.
Could its ruthless CEO, Travis Kalanick, be on his way out? Adam Leshinsky's book is Wild Ride, Inside Uber's Quest for World Domination. He joins us from public station KQED in San Francisco, also the home base of Uber. Welcome to you, Adam.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction.
Well, you really did get the perfect storm.
You did. Now, well, wait a minute. Let me ask you about this. Is that meeting in L.A., has that happened yet? Were they considering a three-month leave of absence board for Kalanick?
My understanding, and from what I'm reading in the press, is that the meeting happened yesterday, but that we don't conclusively know the results of it yet, but that they're expected to be released to employees tomorrow, Tuesday, which means that the rest of us should learn about it then or sooner.
Do you think if they say they want him to take a 3 month leave of absence, does he have to comply? And what will it mean for Uber? And do you think it's a good idea?
So, three questions, and help me if I don't. Remind me if I don't get to all of them. Presumably, Travis Kalanick, is part of this conversation because he and a couple other people actually control the company through their owner, their the way that the shares are constructed. So again, I say presumably he's part of this conversation rather than being forced to do anything. Do I think he will? I think it's highly likely. Remember, for everything that's going on at this company right now, and there's a lot going on, a lot of bad news going on, Travis Kalanick had personal tragedy heaped on top of that. About 2 weeks ago, his mother was killed in a boating accident, and his father was seriously injured in the same accident. And so he has some personal reasons for wanting to step back a little bit. I think the last thing you asked me is, do I think that would be a good idea?
Yes.
You know, we can discuss this as much as you want. Travis Kalanick, I have described as the company's greatest asset and its greatest liability simultaneously. He is responsible for the company being where it is today. He's also responsible for the company's culture and its, you know, the difficult relationships it has with so many different entities. So it feels to me like it would be a good idea for him to take a breather. The problem with that is, it's completely unclear who will run the company, who would run the company after that, and what they might do with this unusual corporate organism, if you will.
What are the highlights of the Holder report?
Well, I haven't seen it. None of us has seen it. So what I can tell you is what his group did, which was to respond to these allegations that were made very publicly in February by a former female Uber engineer who said that she had experienced sexual harassment, and furthermore, that the Human Resources Department had ignored her complaints. Holder's group has then gone and interviewed many, many people throughout the organization with an eye toward reporting back not only on her claims, but on the company's culture in general. And so presumably the recommendations will be, here's who you need to fire and here's what you need to do to right these wrongs.
Okay. Do you think that he'll allow a COO to be hired and let him do his job?
So to unpack your question, it's the right question to be asking. So about a year ago, Kalanick hired the chief marketing officer of Target, whose name is Jeff Jones, about 50, 51 years old, experienced corporate executive, as president of ride sharing. That was the title. He was going to oversee the main business of Uber. And he completely flopped in the job, never gelled with senior management, apparently didn't have Travis Kalanick's trust, and he left the job after about 6 months. So your question is, do I think Travis Kalanick will hire a chief operating officer, as the company has publicly announced that it would, and will he allow that person to do their job? A year ago, the answer ultimately became no. Now I would say the answer is inevitably yes, in particular if Kalanick is on a leave of absence. So it's, you know, there's a lot of hyperbole involved in business reporting, and with this story, we have 17 points of entry we could be discussing right now. I would say that the hiring of this person is the single most important thing that this board of directors and Kalanick, the CEO, can do right now.
You spent quite a bit of time with Kalanick, not only as a magazine editor, but also writing this book. Something that struck me over the weekend while I was reading it, is there a little bit of Donald Trump, or a lot of Donald Trump in Kalanick?
Well, there's a lot of comparisons right now between the Trump administration and Uber, and I guess Trump and Kalanick a little bit. I mean, I know Kalanick. I don't know Donald Trump, other than what I read and see. So they're very, very different people, with different agendas and different worldviews. But they both have the ability to say the wrong thing repeatedly. They're both loved by a certain segment of the population and hated by others. Although I would say right now that Trump is probably more popular with his core supporters than Kalanick is with his. You know, Kalanick's core supporters, otherwise known as riders who ride with Uber, have mostly an unemotional relationship with the product. They take Uber rides because it's convenient and inexpensive, and I would say period. So tell me if you want, if I can answer that question more fully. Those are my top level thoughts on the comparison.
I think you answered it fully.
I'd like to move to your book, Wild Ride. So your research for the book not only included many hours with Kalanick, but you actually worked as an Uber driver for a time. Excuse me,
yes. Doing
a great job. Why were you so dead set on writing this book in spite of his objections on the first go around?
Oh, well, that was my assessment as a business journalist, call it beginning about 4 years ago, was that this was an extremely important business story. I had written a book on Apple that was published in 2012. It was published just after Steve Jobs had died, and I attempted to explain in that book how Apple operated as a business. And as I cast about for my next book, already in 2014 or so, Uber, while still a young company, had expanded quickly around the United States and around the world in a way that a company its age wouldn't have been able to in the era before smartphones. Mm-hmm. So Uber was able to expand quickly because the iPhone was everywhere and the App Store was everywhere, meaning that it could get its app into the hands of users everywhere, literally everywhere. So even before the subsequent events where the company got so much bigger in terms of valuation and employees and revenues, and then even before all of these, this wave of scandal hit, I had a sense that it was a an important story, and I also had a sense that you're referring to the fact that when I first approached Travis Kalanick to write this book, he said no and threatened that he would torpedo the project by hiring somebody to write an authorized version. I also had a sense that I could tell the story without his cooperation, which isn't how things went. He eventually cooperated.
Well, it would have been a very different book, wouldn't it have, had he not acquiesced? Yeah.
Yeah, of course. And you also asked me, I'm happy to come back to that, you asked me about driving for Uber. I became an Uber driver briefly. I was very excited about this because for two reasons. One, I had glamorized in my own mind the idea of driving a taxi, and because I thought it would be fun to go about town and see things and talk to people. I also was excited as a business journalist because it was an opportunity, really for the first time in my career, to participate in the core activity of the company that I was writing about. And ultimately, I'm glad I did it. It was very educational for me, but I really didn't like it. It's tedious work. I don't like being stuck in traffic on my own time, let alone someone else's. The people in the back seat ignore you, which, by the way, is exactly what I do when I'm in the back seat of being driven somewhere. I'm either on my phone or on an or looking at my email or something like that. And the pay isn't very good. So these were some of my observations. And to answer your question, your last question briefly, yes, of course. I've done it. I've been a magazine writer and a book author, and the experience of cooperation versus not getting cooperation is a different one journalistically.
Go back in time a little bit about the beginnings of Uber. At first, it was a black limo company, really. I mean, to get big limousines, especially Mercedes, to important customers.
That's absolutely right. There's a perception, it's repeated every day, including today, that Travis Kalanick founded Uber. That's not true. The idea of the company came from another entrepreneur in San Francisco named Garrett Camp, who earlier had founded a company called StumbleUpon. He hit on the idea of creating an app that you could use to request limousine rides, and he was a frustrated taxi user in San Francisco. San Francisco had and has a terrible taxi system compared to other cities like New York or London, for example. And he started the business specifically to hail limousines, to call limousines. And he was even going to buy cars. He named the company Uber, by the way. You made a reference to Mercedes,
right?
Because Uber sounded like German efficiency to him, like Mercedes. And he really loved the Mercedes S-Class sedan. He was going to buy cars and hire drivers and lease a garage. And his friend Travis Kalanick said to him, "That's a terrible idea. Instead, you should utilize these people as contractors and nothing more. That would be a better business model."
Also, where was I? I wanted to go back just for a second about when you said, yes, it would have been a very different book had you not had access. Would you tell us how?
Sure. I can tell you exactly how, and you can draw your own conclusions, which is, if you don't have access to the company. So with my Apple book, I had almost no access to the company. And so all my reporting was former employees, people who've done business with Apple, and, you know, other knowledgeable observers. And so the story you end up telling is an outsider's look at the inside, as opposed to the other way around. Now, in the case of my Uber book, I was able to do both, but the value of an insider's look and of cooperation is that you get the sense from these people in their words of what they're doing. And without cooperation, is you're putting together a mosaic of their actions from other people's observations.
We're speaking with veteran journalist Adam Leshinsky. He's the executive editor of Fortune magazine. He's also the editorial director of the Fortune Brainstorm Tech Conference. He's written, his latest book is Wild Ride, Inside Uber's Quest for World Domination. A short break. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we continue with Fortune magazine executive editor Adam Leshinsky. We're talking about his book, Wild Ride, Inside Uber's Quest for World Domination. Adam, could you characterize your time spent with Kalinske? Kalanick, I'm sorry.
That's quite
Leshinsky, Kalanick. And
it's a great country we live in. We have a lot of ethnicity.
And how he seems to really embrace kind of wild ideas and tries to implement them and kind of pares them down and yet is genius at the same time.
Sure. So I've been in Silicon Valley for almost exactly 20 years now this week. And so I've been observing this strange place as an outsider for that period of time. And I can tell you that there's a mindset of entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, which is that if something is normal or if it's the way that most of us would do something, that doesn't interest them. That couldn't possibly be interesting. That's the very definition of boring. And Kalanick is almost like an unadulterated version of this in the way that he thinks. So the Uber, for example, started with a very clever idea which understood the technology in the smartphone, that the chips, the accelerometer and the GPS chip particularly could be used to replace the dispatcher system that taxis have used for decades. But Kalanick's mind goes to, and this is how that could work in a city. It's how it could actually work with a real product, with real people. He takes that way of thinking to an extreme. And so what you might be referring to in my conversations with him, he'll come up with zany ideas that are completely impractical and then actually enjoys the way other people would enjoy talking about politics. He enjoys arguing about those things. So, for example, he told me on more than one occasion that he wanted to start a new kind of media company where companies would pay journalists to write the articles, would not interfere with the articles, but then would have a veto power over whether or not to publish the articles. And you know, this clearly was a reflection of his frustration at the kind of press that he was getting. And I told him more than once that that was a completely ridiculous idea, it would never work. And yet he and I would argue about it. He would say, no, let me tell you why it will work. And, you know, there would be eye rolling by other people in the room. And he enjoys this. He would walk away from that as having been a very pleasant experience. And frankly, so did I. I love having conversations like that.
Also, Uber helicopters.
Well, Uber helicopters is a real thing that the company has done on limited occasions for events. The crazy thing you might be referring to is that Uber published a white paper a little less than a year ago about research it was doing into flying cars that would take off vertically and then fly in you know, Jetsons-like format. And you know, I wrote in my book that when they announced this, it felt like an April Fool's joke, except for the list of prestigious, of qualified, pedigreed people who served on an advisory committee, including one scientist from NASA who subsequently became a full-time employee. So they're dead serious about this crazy idea. And, you know, just to belabor the point, the mindset is that if we, as a well-funded Silicon Valley company, aren't thinking about crazy ideas, so think about Google and, you know, balloons, for example, balloons to provide the internet, then we aren't doing our jobs correctly.
I love how you begin the book. I mean, that's a wild ride. His life is a wild ride. You know, there you are with him in China. He's meeting with the premier one day. The next day he's scheduled to go to South Korea, where he's been indicted to appear in court to answer charges against him. Explain that whole scenario, because that was pretty incredible. And what happened with South Korea and going and all that.
Sure. So I think 2 years earlier, Kalanick and Uber had been indicted for operating an illegal taxi service in Seoul. This is the sort of thing that had happened in many places, but not with the exception of the indictment and it being in a country outside the United States. And so the company had been going through legal wrangling with prosecutors in Seoul for some period of time and had negotiated an agreement whereby, since Kalanick was going to be nearby in China, they would rent a private jet and fly in and agree to the terms that the prosecutor had suggested, which to sort of give shorthand to it was to plead guilty to a low-level charge and be excused to leave the country. And I was with them at the time, we were driving from the coastal city of Tianjin, where he had been at a World Economic Forum conference, to Beijing, where he was going to spend a day in meetings, was on the phone with his team of lawyers and others. The circumstances had changed. The press had found out that Kalanick was coming to Seoul, and he and they were very concerned. He in particular was very concerned that he was going to be perp-walked. In other words, if you think of the scene from Bonfire of the Vanities, that he was going to be manacled and paraded in front of the press, and that they were going to make a spectacle of this, which was not an unreasonable concern. So I was sort of present for this argument about what the right thing to do. To make a long story short, and I'm happy to make it as long a story as you like, they decided not to go to Seoul the next day, that he was not going to submit himself to the potential for this public spectacle, and that he would not appear in Korea, which means that he really can't go back to Korea right now because he has now thumbed his nose at the prosecutors in Seoul. And what to me, what sort of put the cherry on the sundae of this tense conversation and argument among his people was that I saw him the next morning in a very lovely hotel in Beijing, and it was as if the whole thing had never happened. Mm-hmm. He was freshly showered, freshly eating an omelet and with fresh clothes on, and all the weight of the previous day's very tense negotiations were gone.
Didn't he say something about listening to his heart or his head rather than his heart or something, and that he decided not to go, and could he have landed in jail?
Well, I think you're conflating two different episodes that both have to do with China. On the first part, the conversation that I had with him, I said, you know, are you upset about what happened with Korea? And his response was something like, you know, no, this is sort of my life's work. We've been fighting corrupt situations like this for years now. And what he meant by that was that, you know, that there was nothing illegal about what they were doing in Korea, which shows you his hubris and the company's hubris, that they would dictate to the Korean government or to the Seoul government what was legal in their jurisdiction. And remember, I'm explaining, not justifying. They had done this repeatedly in the United States, where they had said to people, where they had said to jurisdictions, your laws are corrupt, we want to change them. And they did. The comment that you're referring to about I followed my head, not my heart, was just about 2 months after that, Uber announced that it was abandoning its efforts in China altogether, because even though he wanted to fight in every circumstance and he wanted to be in the world's second biggest economy and the world's most populous country, it wasn't working. They were not going to succeed in Uber, and so in China, and so he waved the white flag and said, "Yes, I told you I never give up, but in this instance, I need to do the pragmatic thing and listen to my head."
For those who either ride or drive for Uber, explain his steadfast support of surge pricing and how it works.
Sure. So surge pricing, it's referred to more generally as dynamic pricing. It's something that hotels and airlines do. For example, you pay for your airfare or for your hotel room, depending on how much demand there is for the room and how badly the hotel or the airline needs to sell you that ticket or that seat or that room. In the case of Uber, they developed a process early on called surge pricing, that when there was increased demand, typically in an urban center, but not only in the center of the city, they would charge more money. And by charging more money, they would encourage more drivers to start driving, because remember, drivers can drive whenever they feel like it. And they would notify them, there's surge pricing in your city, please go drive if you want to make money. They would also discourage some riders from riding. They knew that people would go through the determination, oh, this is too expensive, I'll figure out another way to get to where I wanted to go. And so they would be simultaneously stimulating supply and diminishing demand, which from a pure economics perspective would bring pricing and demand into equilibrium.
Sort of like pricing on expressway lanes.
The high occupancy vehicle lanes, yeah, would be one form of diminishing demand. Right. That's exactly right. But... So to Travis Kalanick and people around him, this was completely rational. And of course, from an economics perspective, it is completely rational, except when you throw into the mix that getting around is an emotional thing for people, and price gouging is neither rational nor legal. And so when surge pricing travels into price gouging, people get infuriated, and he seemed unable to grasp this.
Mm. Veteran journalist Adam Leshinsky has written Wild Ride: Inside Uber's Quest for World Domination. A short break. We'll be back. We'll open the phones and the email. Stay with us.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, we're back with today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. We're visiting with Adam Leshinsky, and we're talking about his latest book, Wild Ride: Inside Uber's Quest for World Domination. If you'd like to join in with a question or a comment, you're certainly welcome. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email, please keep them brief, radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org. Perhaps you're a driver or a user.
Or perhaps you don't use it because you ascribe to the credo, you don't get into a car with a stranger. Adam, does he see himself as some kind of a hero who's totally misunderstood?
I think so. There's an element of that. I have this one of the final scenes in my book is a very long walk that I took with Kalanick through the streets of San Francisco on a July evening for more than 3 hours, and he implied that very thing to me. I don't know what I'm allowed to say on public radio. He's been called a word that begins with an A and ends with hole frequently. He's aware of that.
Right.
I gave a talk, by the way, last week, and my best friend's 10-year-old son was in the audience, and so I replaced that word with really bad guy every time I made reference to it. And Kalanick said to me, people are going to ask you, is he one? And I don't think I am. Maybe I trigger something in somebody. It was, and so in my book, I purposely didn't answer the question. Instead, I wanted to show the reader how he grappled with this and what his perspective on it was.
And I guess, going back to the whole thing of getting access to him, did you figure out what makes him tick? I mean, is it money? Is it fame? Is it, making it easy for people to get around town? I mean, he had other startups that didn't work. What did you figure out? Were you able to get inside his head?
Well, the way I framed the question that you're asking me right now is, could I figure out what his rosebud was?
Yeah.
And I'm sorry to say I didn't. I don't know of some deep-seated childhood psychological event that made Travis Kalanick who he is today. But I can answer some of your other questions. From my perspective, he's not particularly motivated by money. People scoff at that, but I can tell you he's not a big spender. As a matter of fact, he made it very difficult for anybody at the company, including himself, to reap any financial rewards from selling stock for quite a long time. They've loosened up on that recently. I don't think he's particularly motivated by fame either, at least not in any sort of extraordinary way. I think he's very motivated to succeed. He burns with this desire for his company to be this outsized success, and for him to be the person who orchestrates that. But I don't have any evidence that that's about being rich, which I certainly have seen with other Silicon Valley entrepreneurs.
If anyone would be aware of how quickly videos can go viral, what about Kalanick berating one of his own drivers?
Right. Well, you're referring to the episode in February of this year, right, where a driver, a longtime driver, by the way, for Uber Black, their original town car limousine service, posted a video taken from a webcam on his car of Kalanick berating him after this driver had given him criticism of what the changes in commissions and pricing had done to this driver. And Kalanick yelled at him as he was getting out of the car and said, people need to take responsibility for their own actions. What made that episode interesting for me is that I had a similar but different experience. That same night that I was walking with Kalanick, we took an Uber back to the corporate headquarters on the other side of town. We had basically walked around the peninsula of San Francisco. And very shortly after we got in the car and we were talking, the driver recognized that he had the CEO of Uber in his back seat. And the driver proceeded to really to relatively politely give Kalanick chapter and verse about what the problems of being an Uber driver were. Now, in that instance, Kalanick engaged in a very substantive and respectful conversation with him and promised to follow up by email. He then sent me the email to show me that he had followed up. I later said how much of that was because I was in the back seat. Right. And I want to point out, I had these conversations before that video surfaced. And he said to me, oh, I have those kinds of conversations with drivers all the time. You'd be surprised. So, you know, again, all I can tell you is that I witnessed what I witnessed, and then we all witnessed what happened after that.
You know, everything has its double edge. And here we have this most successful startup ever with all these scandals, plagued by all these scandals. Do you think their greatest problem is Travis Kalanick, or do you think it's something else?
Well, I think to say that their greatest problem is Travis Kalanick, there's a case to be made there, and it might be accurate, but it's probably an oversimplification. Mm. I just reframe it and say that their greatest problem is the culture and the way of doing business that he created and that he championed. This, you know, take no prisoners, thumb your nose at authority always. So, you know, it's possible that removing him from the scenario could begin the process of fixing those things. I'd like to point out two other things. One, we want to be careful not to be unidimensional about the company. They are capable of fixing things. So, for example, the regulatory approach that they took at the beginning, they later changed when they realized they had taken it as far as they could. They hired hundreds of lobbyists and started working with regulators and legislators. And most of the time, successfully. The other thing is, for quite justifiable reasons, this company has now been scrutinized internally and externally more than any company I've ever witnessed, let alone a private company that hadn't listed its shares publicly. You know, I would hate for my every moment to be recorded by a webcam and then distributed publicly. Yeah. I promise you there's something in my behavior that I would be embarrassed by. And by the same token, and I would just want to repeat, I'm not making any apologies for this company, but by the same token, many companies, if you invited in the former U.S. Attorney General with a team of corporate lawyers to interview hundreds or thousands of them and said, tell me everything that's ever gone wrong here, you know, might be embarrassing. Again, no apology, but those are the things that have happened here.
Our telephone number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. And we'll take a first caller, Joe in Fort Lauderdale. He's a driver. Joe, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
My question, Paul, about this. When a customer picks a pool ride, the rationale from what I understand from the driver's perspective is they don't get paid for that pool ride. Why is that?
You're talking about the carpool okay.
Exactly.
I think I can explain the.
Yeah.
Okay, so ahead.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Adam.
Sure. So what the caller is referring to, the caller is an Uber driver. Uber has a product called Uber Pool. It's a less expensive option for riders. Rather than call an Uber driver to take you directly where you want to go, you can hit a button for a cheaper alternative called Uber Pool. You might then have to share your ride with other people, but you'll pay less for it. And the driver is saying that I should be paid for each of these drop-offs, not just for the one ride. And this is one of many, many arguments that people have with the way Uber has designed its payment system with drivers. Uber has been has almost been alarmingly tone deaf to criticisms from drivers, including on things like this. But the list is very long of the things that they're criticized by. And so one of these existential questions about the company's future is, how can it survive with such difficult relationships with drivers? And of course, we didn't even discuss this yet, but the company has publicly said it's trying to eliminate those drivers by designing robots to drive autonomous vehicles. But Uber still offers this opportunity for people to make cash quickly, and many, many people embrace it despite all their criticisms.
Yeah, and there aren't that many jobs, and it gives you incredible flexibility, and you work when you want, as much or as little.
And that is the upside. If you want to work, you turn on the app, you accept a ride, and you take it. And as you point out, it's a fascinating moment in the culture where despite the economy doing well the way it's measured, there's a lot of people who are hurting. And Uber and its competitors have offered people the opportunity to make some cash quickly on their terms. But it isn't perfect and it isn't easy.
Next up, we have another caller, Steve in Fort Lauderdale. Steve, you're up. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call. I'll just get right to it. I'd like to just ask if you think that my viewpoint is valid or not. I look at Uber to be the exact same equivalent as organized crime, the mob. I'll make some statements. We have a business designed to break laws, whether it be you don't have a taxi medallion, you don't have a chauffeur's license, you don't have insurance to cover things. The company knows that it's breaking the laws. It admits that when it says, oh, if my folks get into trouble, we'll pay the fines for them, equivalent to the mob saying, hey, we'll get you out of jail. And then they have also designed the company to avoid paying taxes. They classify people as contractors instead of employees. Right. And we're not going to pay your Social Security tax. We're not going to pay other taxes. We're going to avoid things. Isn't this conspiracy to commit crimes and in an organized way and also essentially almost, avoid tax evasion? Isn't that what we convict mobsters on?
Adam?
If you could just comment on that comparison. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm happy to take it. And it's obviously, people who drink beer could have many beers and discuss this philosophically. You're positing on the one hand, making a comparison with people who, according to what I see in the movies, kill people and do extortion as the laws that they break, versus the types of laws that Uber has said it was going to break. Many of us speed down the freeway, which is also breaking a law. And I'm not going to get into the equivalency of that. You can do that. Company does have requirements around drivers having insurance, and the company does presume that drivers will pay their taxes and gives them a bare minimum of help in doing that. But I understand that's not the point you were making, that the company has not hired these people as employees so that they can make Social Security deductions in a traditional way. And so I would say that, philosophically or academically or intellectually, your points are totally valid, but then we need to have we need to go down a layer to discuss them from a policy or from a polity perspective.
We have an emailer, Ingrid. As a woman Uber driver for 8 months, I find it completely unsafe for me. I'm not my own boss, considering I cannot cannot choose which passengers to pick up or refuse, especially Uber pools. If I do refuse or do not accept pickups, I get penalized after refusing 3 in a row. I also know for a fact that the passengers are charged more than what I'm told, thereby I'm being paid by a lower amount and not the amount that the passenger is actually being charged by Uber. Very deceptive practices. What can be done about safety for the drivers and correct compensation? I don't know that that's in your purview, but go ahead.
Well, it's
you're not working with Eric Holder.
Yeah, well, it's right. I can't make policy and this, but I can tell you, I can give you a few anecdotes. So I don't know about what's going on in Miami or in Dade County. I can tell you that that, in fact, it was discovered that Uber was underpaying its drivers in New York City, and this has been quite expensive for them to rectify. Their systems were out of whack, or they were venal. I don't know which, but that's what's going on in New York. I've heard anecdotally to this woman's question that a lot of women... You're going to laugh at this, but I have heard this, that a lot of women prefer to do Uber Eats, which is Uber's food delivery service, because they would rather have food in the car with them than, as this woman suggests, men who they might find to be unsavory characters.
Right.
Anyway, again, I should probably stop there. That's what I've observed.
Okay, we need to take our last break. We're speaking with Adam Leshinsky. He's the executive editor of Fortune. His latest book is Wild Ride, Inside Uber's Quest for World Domination. We'll be right back and take your calls.
And we're back with today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Adam Leshinsky is with us. We're talking about his book, Wild Ride, Inside Uber's Quest for World Domination. Quickly back to our callers. We've got Danny in Miami. Danny, you're up. Hi.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to chime in. I use Uber quite often, several times per week, and I'll give my brief experiences in that. Many people, some of your last callers, have negative things to say. And in my experience, those that have anything negative to say about Uber are almost always the individuals that very seldom use the service. I'm an accountant. I happen to know that Uber pays millions of dollars in taxes. So they make plenty of revenue. As far as the individual that spoke about not being able to choose your occupants, yeah, that's true in any capacity, whether you're a cab driver or you're flying planes. What Uber does is it puts the power into the riders. We're able to choose our drivers in the car and this and that. It's so much more reliable than any taxi. It's prompt. You know when it's coming. It's efficient. Many Uber rides that I've taken, they offer you free water. You can charge your phone. They have little snacks. Many of these people have other jobs. They talk about their kids. And when you compare it to taxis, I mean, and I'll wrap up. I once read not too long ago that Uber's on the brink of having more revenue than every cab company on planet Earth combined. So when something is that revolutionary, it's obviously working and the people like it. So it's cheaper, it's more reliable, it's clean, it's friendly, they all have insurance. So yes, internally there may be some things that they need to tidy up, and I would imagine any major corporation that has such tremendous growth goes through such learning pains. But I would encourage, just as I did to my local legislators many years ago that were trying to block some of the Uber sharing activities, take Uber, experience it, and you'll learn a lot. And if you're not using it, it doesn't mean that you should say anything negative about it. I'll take my comments off the air.
Danny, I just want to say, yes, you might have a future with Uber. I don't know about the accounting, but okay, thanks, Danny.
Have a good day.
You too.
Okay, thanks for your call. We'll move along to Ed in Pompano. I'm short on time, Ed. Hi.
Hey, I know that last caller was spot on. I'm a pilot. I use them all over the United States. Kind of transition from limousines and taxis to the Uber, and it's been phenomenal. They come when I ask them to. Whenever somebody has a gripe about it, I ask them, how many times have you griped about taxis? And there's many, many times more gripes about taxis and the cleanliness and stuff. The drivers, I noticed most of them are Uber / Lyft drivers, so they've told me that they get paid more with Lyft, so I've been using Lyft quite a bit more, because I know that the drivers get a little chunk of the pie there. And Uber, you know, the things that are important to Uber over time, if Lyft gets bigger because of the shortfalls in some of their business model, they're going to address that. And until then, you know, use Lyft. They're as good, even better. They pay the drivers more, and you know, I've never had a problem with either one of them. I've had some funny stories, but, you know, nothing that even compares to the horrible type drives I've had with some of the taxi drivers.
Right. Okay, Adam. Thank you for calling in.
These two callers have sort of are presenting the cup half full, as I said it earlier, and we also forget that before all of Uber's scandals, they experienced the love of people like this, which was, by the way, integral in getting going in many jurisdictions. They asked riders to call their, you know, call their regulators, their legislators, the mayors, and say we want this product because it's better. The only difference being that taxis are just more highly regulated, and so there's a perception and sometimes the reality that can make for a safer environment compared with, as you pointed out earlier, getting in the car with a stranger.
Adam, you're pretty interesting. How did you get to Fortune? Tell us more about you.
Sure. I'm from the Midwest. I'm a Chicagoan by birth and sentiment, and I had lived in Washington, D.C. and Tokyo, and I got a job at the San Jose Mercury News exactly 20 years ago, covering what was then the rise of what became the dot-com bubble. And I developed an expertise in writing about the strategy and the management and the finances of technology companies, not the technology of the technology companies. And in fairly short order, about 15 years ago, that led me to doing that for Fortune.
Let's squeeze in another caller. So we've got Steve in Fort Lauderdale. You're up. Hi. Steve.
Oh, hi. Am I in India?
Yes.
Yes, I have two questions. The first one is about Lyft and Uber. I was wondering if it's the same company. That's the first question. The second one is about the business model that Uber is using. Basically, I like to compare it with Airbnb, where Airbnb is a broker, and it puts the host with the guest, and the host set up the price, and everybody's happy, right? Mm. But Uber changes the whole model totally. At first, the price was okay. They set up the price themselves. But they decided to slash the price whenever they want without any input from the driver. So I was wondering, what do you think about this basically business model problem?
Sure. Both great questions. The first one is would be a fascinating question for Uber and Lyft, because I can tell you they're completely different companies, both based in San Francisco. Both raised a lot of money, hundreds of millions and billions in the case of Uber, from venture capitalists. And they're so similar in some instances that, as a previous caller pointed out, many drivers drive for both. So the service is indistinguishable in some cases. But they're completely different companies following very similar business models. To your other question, the word that people in Silicon Valley would use rather than broker is marketplace. Airbnb and Uber have created a marketplace for the products, the services that they're providing. In the case of Uber, acts far more as an agent or an agency setting prices, whereas Airbnb, what they call the hosts, otherwise known as the people who own the properties, set their prices and then see how they do with it. Uber is far more controlling, and those have rooms to rent and which are highly differentiated, and rides in a city, in an urban area, which are not highly differentiated, are arguably two different products, so they take two different pricing mechanisms.
Well, thank you for calling, Steve. We've been speaking with veteran journalist Adam Leshinsky. He's the executive editor of Fortune. He's also the editorial director of the Fortune Brainstorm Tech Conference and a co-chair of Fortune Global Forum. He's also a best-selling author and a regular contributor on Fox News. He's written Inside Apple. That was his book before Wild Ride, Inside Uber's Quest for World Domination. Adam Leshinsky, thank you very much for the book.
Thank you, Adam.
And for being with us.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you.
And that wraps up today's edition. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Our lead producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from online content producer Jason Zemke. Polly Landis is associate producer. As always, we have free audio archives of each program available at our website. That's WLRN.org. There's also the iTunes podcast, as well as the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow, we look at the National Young Arts Program and Foundation, based in Miami since 1981. These are the most artistically talented high school students in the nation who are groomed for success in many genres. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.